This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I am Meera Sivasuthi. It's our psychiatry series. Dr. Robin Gonzaga, consultant psychiatrist, in the studio with me. Today we're going to be discussing helping families cope with suicide. Now, suicide, we all know, affects entire families and communities. How do they cope with it when they, you know, lose a loved one to suicide? So that's what we're going to be speaking about today. If you have a question for Dr. Robin, please give us a call. The number is 03-77-33-2900. You can WhatsApp 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Welcome to the show, Dr. Robin. How are you today?
Hi, good afternoon. Fine, thank you. How are you?
I am well. I mean, you know, can you just share with me? I mean, we planned this show about 3-4 weeks ago, am I correct? And I understand over the last, 2 weeks or so, you've seen a lot of suicide cases for some reason. How do you cope with that? And you know, was it? Do you see this coming in? Is there like a cycle, or you know, you can never tell?
Well, what I have seen recently is a lot of people who have been contemplating suicide. In one instance, someone who's attempted suicide, and this very morning, someone who's actually committed suicide. Unfortunately, someone who was booked in to see me this morning, it was a very sad situation. She was booked in to see me this morning by her husband and never made the appointment. And then it was very sweet because later on he called and apologized for his wife not showing up. And he said she jumped off the balcony of the apartment this morning. So that was something that happened today. But yes, recently, I don't know what it is. I have no explanation for, you know, as to why it's happening. But certainly there has been an increase in the occurrences of people who have been having suicidal thoughts and have actually made some attempts on their lives.
Okay, let's talk about suicide ideation and suicide attempts. What is the difference?
Okay, well, suicide, you know, first of all, is the intentional causing of one's own death. Okay. And the difference between, did you say suicidal ideation or suicidal attempt?
Yep.
Okay, so suicidal ideation is effectively when you're thinking about suicide, okay? Thinking and planning, these are the two big things. So when someone is thinking and planning about suicide, they will be thinking and planning about methods in which they may do it. You know, they may be researching it. And unfortunately, on the internet, is not short of, you know, sites where people can go and look these things up on. They may be making preparations, for example, buying medication and storing it, obtaining firearms legally, and taking pains not to be found, doing all these things. So an ideation would imply thinking about it in a serious fashion and making plans. A suicidal attempt per se is actually someone who's attempting to do something. It would basically refer to someone who has not completely, obviously, committed suicide. So it's not a completed suicide, which has resulted in death, but certainly someone who is trying to take their life. And it's also, if I may just say, to add on that, suicidal attempts, we obviously see quite a few of these, and I've seen my fair share in my practice over the years. What I do have to say is that for people who try to commit suicide, whether it may be an act of what we call deliberate self-harm, which is usually a call or a cry for help or to bring attention to one's suffering, or an actual suicidal attempt, which is an attempt to take one's life, which obviously has been unsuccessful, sometimes these situations lead to serious harm. For example, there was a case of a girl in the U.S. who took a gun and tried to shoot herself in the head. What she did, unfortunately, was to shoot her face off, and she survived. And she's recently had a face transplant. And there was another gentleman who I personally know of who tried to commit suicide by taking an overdose of insulin because he happened to be an insulin-dependent diabetic. Unfortunately, he didn't die. He put himself into a coma for he continued to live in a coma for about 5 years before he actually did expire. So people who commit acts of deliberate self-harm or who try to attempt suicide sometimes don't always succeed, and unfortunately then can do themselves some irreparable harm and, you know, cause a lot of suffering.
Yeah, you know, you spoke about that case this morning of the lady who didn't make the appointment.
Yeah.
Let's just, you know, take her husband for an example, who obviously knew she had suicidal thoughts and made that appointment to bring her to see you.
Yeah.
What could he have done in the meantime?
Well,
knowing that, you know,
yeah,
she was already vulnerable.
Well, I don't know the details, the exact details, but let's assume that he knew that she was very depressed and she was suicidal. So the first thing you'd have to do is to ensure one is safe. So, and by safe, I mean have no access to something that could potentially harm you, or in this case, someone who lives in an apartment. So steps could be taken to just, you know, lock the windows or take the person away from that place, you know, from that high-rise place. So, you know, it's safety. And so in some instances, that may also mean, for example, calling the police or to get aid from some other agency to physically remove somebody and take them to a place of safety, which in this situation, if someone was threatening suicide and was an imminent risk to themselves, would mean containment in a hospital, you know, purely for their own safety, until one can work out what we need to do and what treatment needs to take place.
We criminalize suicide in this country, and I can imagine how people would call the police. You know, they would be the last resort, really.
Mm-hmm.
What are your thoughts on that? Because Deputy Minister of Women, Family and Community Development, Hannah Yeo, has said earlier this year that this law is archaic and it should be reviewed. I mean, from your experience, how does the criminal stigma of suicide do more harm to the individuals and their families?
It's a bit of an odd law. I'm not quite sure who thought of this law, because how do you criminalize someone who's dead? You know, if someone has committed suicide, what is the point of calling it a criminal act? Because that person is not here to answer for the act of what they've done. But where it becomes significant is for people who attempt suicide or who attempt acts of deliberate self-harm, because those are seen as, based on that law, are things that are considered to be criminal acts and can be reported to the police for them to take action upon, which again does not make any sense whatsoever. It's an archaic law. It was badly thought out. I'm not sure what its intentions were, but I can tell you something. With a law like that, what will happen is that it will just make people not want to come and seek help and be open about, you know, their sort of struggles if they're feeling suicidal or they've attempted something or if they're going to attempt something.
And, you know, who do people usually turn to when, you know, there is somebody in the family who has suicidal thoughts? I mean, yeah. What do you do? It is such a difficult situation to be in as a family member, especially. I mean, there's so much stigma and taboo around this. You don't want to tell anyone about it because it's almost a sign of a weakness, would mm-hmm. you say?
Well, it depends on the individual. It depends on lots of different things like their educational background, their social status, their religious affiliations, right? But generally speaking, I think in this day and age and in our urban society, a lot of people would probably turn to their family doctors as a first port of call. Or they may go to relatives or family if they feel they can trust someone. Like, for example, children sometimes may not necessarily want to go to their parents, but they may go to an uncle or an aunt or a cousin, or, you know, someone whom they can identify with as being, you know, someone who can be supportive. A lot of people turn to friends. A lot of people also turn to religious leaders, go to talk to their priest or their imam or the monk, or, you know, somebody who they feel can give them some understanding and guidance. Then, of course, there are helplines that people can call, like the Befrienders, you know, for example, has been around for a long time, and they provide support and counselling. And if necessary, you know, they can help, you know, refer someone else to get help.
Dr. Robin Gonzaga, consultant psychiatrist in the studio with us. We're discussing helping families cope with suicide. If you have a question for us, give us a call. The number is 03- 07733 2900. You can WhatsApp 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. How do you assess someone for suicide risk, Dr. Robin?
So from a point of view of mental health, as a psychiatrist, we would obviously want to do a clinical assessment, which would involve seeing the patient and also seeing the carers or the relatives or whoever is around that patient. So it would be an interview, a structured interview, and we would assess their suicidal ideation, which we just talked about. Mm-hmm. You know their plans, their notes, their timing, whatever that they may have indulged in. The other important thing is to look at previous attempts. If they've attempted self-harm or even attempted suicide in the past, that's one of the most significant factors to take into account for future attempts, because previous attempts are a serious indicator of future attempts. The other thing that we look at, we assess things like their support network, whether they have family and friends around them who can be of support to them, their religious affiliations, because being religious, believe it or not, is seen as a protective thing. So these are avenues that we can then use to try and help someone who is, you know, suicidal. We also look at things like the presence of mental illness, because that, unfortunately, is one of the big risk factors for completed suicide, in particular things like chronic depression, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder. And the other thing that we also look at are the presence of chronic physical illnesses, especially ones that cause chronic pain. You know, for example, things like rheumatoid arthritis, where there's immobility, where there's deformity, and sometimes the pain mechanisms may not the pain medications rather may not be as effective or be as well prescribed as they should be, and people can sit down and suffer with chronic pain, which is extremely, extremely difficult to cope with.
What have been your observations of patients who come and see you, from Malaysia?
Yeah.
What have been some of your challenges dealing with patients who are indeed suicidal and their families?
I think it is one of the biggest challenges is to deal with the highly charged emotional situation that everyone's in. Obviously, you know, the patient, we would have to make sure that they're safe, number one. Then we need to also look at the relatives or the caregivers that accompany the patient to manage their levels of distress and their expectations. And, you know, we have to look into so many different factors, like, you know, we just talked about, religious affiliations. Like, for example, in the Catholic religion, and I think in Islam, if I'm not mistaken, suicide is technically seen as a sin. So we've got to manage that whole piece of we can't talk about it as someone is trying to kill themselves, but, give it some other name and try to work around that. So it's really quite difficult. We have to manage on so many different levels, and it's tough. I mean, there's no one-size-fits-all, you know.
Okay. Sounds like a challenge indeed.
It is indeed.
We're discussing helping families cope with suicide. Dr. Robin Gonzaga, consultant psychiatrist in the studio with us. If you have a question, once again, give us a call. 03773 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, or tweet us at BFM Radio. When we come back, we'll find out a little bit more about junior doctors in this country. They say they've been bullied at their workplace, with about 17% of them saying it was so bad that they thought of ending their lives. So how do we deal with that, as well as, you know, if you're a family member and you have a question, or you're in this difficult situation, don't have to give us your name. Just ask your question and we'll get Dr. Robin to address it on air. Coming up next on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Meera Sivasuthi. In our Health and Living segment, Dr. Robin Gonzaga, consultant psychiatrist in the studio with me. We're discussing helping families cope with suicide. Once again, you can give us a call if you have a question. The number is 03773 2900. You can WhatsApp 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Dr. Robin, there's a question here from Mr. Muniandi. He's asking, if you can talk about undetected thyroid dysfunction and psychiatric symptoms from that, is there a relationship? Undetected thyroid dysfunction.
Undetected thyroid dysfunctions and psychiatric symptoms? Well, certainly thyroid disorders can mimic psychiatric symptoms. Say, for example, an underactive thyroid can sometimes present with as a depression. So that's something actually I wouldn't say frequently, but I have picked up a few people with hypothyroidism in my clinic who are presented with depression. And conversely, an overactive thyroid can present with symptoms such as anxiety or even a symptom suggestive of mania, where they're running around, hyper and, doing all sorts of things with lots of energy. Haven't seen so many of those, but certainly there are some overlaps in terms of the symptoms. But in relation to suicide, as far as I know, there is no link of any thyroid disorders and suicide.
Okay, so once you fix the thyroid problem, then those symptoms go away?
No.
Really?
Unfortunately, this is where the thing is quite complicating. You can fix the thyroid problems, and sometimes some of the symptoms may reduce in their severity, but they will probably still need psychiatric intervention.
Why is that?
Good question. I don't know. And there's lots of people have looked into this, and it is thought that the thyroid hormone has some effect on the neurotransmitters in the brains, in the brain rather. And so if the neurotransmitters are disturbed by abnormal thyroid function, so putting the thyroid function may not necessarily restore neurotransmitter function in the way that it was before. So frequently we find people, I have lots of patients who have hypothyroidism and hypothyroidism who have been treated successfully and have their bloods all looking normal but still have ongoing symptoms of low mood or anxiety and still need psychiatric medication.
Okay. And coming back to someone who is thinking about attempting suicide, how does psychological or even psychiatric therapy help? Or is there a need for medication immediately in cases like these?
Well, it depends on what the situation is like. And, as I say, the most important situation and the most important thing to do at a time like that is to ensure safety and that someone is, safe from, committing something, tragic. So we diffuse the immediate situation. And if that means containment into admission to hospital for containment, as I mentioned before. But then you also want to look at if someone is kind of stressed out about something and it's, been on their mind for a long time, you want to look to see if you can offer any particular solutions, to their problem, or to give them hope that we can look at different things to help them through through a difficult situations. And psychological help, would sort of fall into that category. We also want to look at enhancing their support networks, family, friends, and especially in terms of communication, making sure everyone knows how to communicate with someone who is suicidal. For example, I've had people who will say things like, oh, you shouldn't be suicidal. You should be grateful for everything you have. That's not what they want to hear at that point in time, Sorry, you're going to say something?
But then again, sometimes they're in denial. They're not going to come forward and get help. So my next question is, sometimes the closest person to the person at risk finds it the most difficult to help. And if that's the case, like your partner, your friend or your family member, how then do you help them?
Well, if you can't help them, then you get them help from outside.
How? So my next question is, can you get somebody help or make them go and get help against their own will?
I think we talked about this before. I think, if someone is suicidal, the first and most important thing is to make them safe. So if they refuse to get help, then you have to intervene to take that choice away from them and get them contained in a place where they can be safe. And then starts the hard work, which is basically trying to evaluate what is going wrong. If it's a mental illness, what we can do to try and treat it. If it's a psychological problem, what we can do to try and address it. If it's a problem, which they've been thinking about for a long time and don't see any potential solutions, we can try and help them with that. So it just depends, really.
Okay. Yeah. And how do you include the family members or the caregivers in this treatment process?
Slowly, I think it's very important because if they live, I mean, say, for example, if a young person lives with their family and is suicidal, then you want to make sure that the family are involved, they know what is going on, they understand the whole situation. And if we can share some information about what is going on in this person's mind and what might be driving some of the thoughts related to suicide, to look at see how the family dynamics may potentially play a role in leading to, you know, feelings of hopelessness or sadness or what have you. So the family is quite important.
Really, I feel sometimes it's the most difficult for the family to deal with or to get through to the person, actually.
I think you're looking at two separate things. You're looking at two different things. It's about, you're talking about how people from the family can help someone who is suicidal, and maybe they can't. So that's why they may need to get professional help. Mm-hmm. But in the meantime, there's lots of other things they can do, you know, such as support, such as, you know, not saying, you know, what I say, the wrong things in inverted commas, right? And not inflame the situation. So there are other things they can do if they can't actually do sort of, you know, something hands-on to, you know, sort of get rid of this, of the situation.
Could you give me other examples of what we shouldn't be saying? We're very Asian. We're very, you know... local.
Well, you know, like, for example,
like, get on with your life.
I've sat in a room and I've heard, you know, a mother say to her son, "Why are you suicidal? I've given you everything. Come on, you know, tell me what's going through your head." And, you know, it's not the kind of thing they want to hear at that point in time. They don't need a guilt trip, you know. Or there are other things like, you know, you shouldn't be suicidal, you know, because if you die, then I see no point in living, you know, that... Again, they don't need any additional burdens put on them at that point in time. Yeah.
And, you know, in the case of adolescents, they need parental consent to seek psychiatric care, right? So, but some teens may not want to talk to their parents about what they're actually going through. I think that's a group that's very difficult to actually, you need to get it out of them. And how do you do that?
Sorry, you said that... The adolescents, they need consent to get psychiatric care. No, I don't think anyone needs consent to see a doctor. What we need is the doctor needs consent to talk about the individual to another person. I mean, if an adolescent wanted to go and see a doctor, they could walk in and see a doctor. They don't have necessarily, in my opinion, have to get the parents' permission.
Someone needs to pay your bill, Dr. Rabin.
Well, that's a different matter.
Yes.
That's a different matter.
But, that's a big problem.
But the complication happens to be when, for example, if an adolescent comes in and tells me that they want to take their life, then I have to break a confidentiality, a doctor-patient confidentiality, because that person is a minor and their parents are responsible for them. So you have to just break a confidentiality, report it, and take the necessary steps.
Okay. And do you do, like, family counselling? Is that important for, the patient?
Well, yes, it is important in terms of education and just making sure that they know what is going on and how to support. Yeah, that's extremely important.
I mean, is it ever enough, though? I mean, family counselling, is that ever enough to deal with these situations?
Is there ever enough, meaning...
Is counselling ever enough? I mean, can you actually cover all grounds when it comes to helping families cope with these patients?
Well, there's different phases, I would imagine, of counselling. There's the immediate phase where you're trying to diffuse the situation and educate everyone involved. And then that's the short term. And then there's the long term situation, which is actually more difficult because that has to be managed over an extended period of time. So that sort of takes on a bit more complexity.
Okay, let's talk about the medical profession. Who looks after the mental well-being of doctors? And there was a report recently that junior doctors in this country have been bullied at their workplace, and with about 17% of them saying it was so bad that they thought of ending their lives. I mean, is that surprising to you, though?
Is what surprising?
That they have thoughts of ending their lives.
No, because doctors are just like everybody else, and we are also... allowed to have suicidal thoughts, and certainly doctors are at a higher risk from the general population of committing suicide. In fact, we've got about double the risk of the general population of actual suicide. So, yeah.
So, who supports them?
Other doctors, hopefully.
Really?
Yep.
How then do you bridge that ethical and legal aspects of having a mental health issue? I mean, ethical meaning, you know, are you in a position to practice if you do have a mental health condition? You know, legal aspects, will you stand the chance of losing your practicing certificate, for an example?
I think if you are a risk in any shape or form, you would have to report that to the medical council, who will then eventually make a determination on your suitability to practice once you've received treatment and once you've received support that you need.
Okay. And is that a big issue in Malaysia?
I don't know, because I've not been in that situation where I had to report anyone to the medical council.
When do you do that?
When they're a risk to...
Such
other,
as?
Well, if their judgment is impaired, like say, for example, if someone is, you know, manic, you know, let's say, for example, for argument's sake, a surgeon became manic and suddenly decided he could do 10 surgeries a day when in actual fact he should really be doing 3 or 4, okay? So, and starts, you know, putting lots of people on his lists, and starts becoming a bit gung-ho about what he's doing. And then someone has to intervene and say, okay, this is not on. It's no different from a pilot who gets into a cockpit and who's drunk and is about to try and fly a plane. So we'd have to intervene and say, no, you can't do this. Mm-hmm. It's not safe, you know. That would be the kind of intervention that we'd have to.
Okay. You were saying the medical profession doubled the number of mental health issues of the...
Double the suicide rate of the general population. The general population has a suicide rate, by the WHO estimates, about 10.8 per 100,000 people. The latest American Psychiatric Association estimates for suicide amongst physicians, and this is in the US, is something between 28 to 40 per 100,000 physicians.
That's a huge number.
Yep, it's more than double, yep.
Why? What's happening?
What's happening?
Is it the job? Is it a occupational hazard?
Well, it's a very stressful job. You know, it's extremely stressful because there's lots of time that you invest in training, in study, and then there's lots of things that maybe have got to manage expectations of our own, you know, in terms of success. We've got to manage expectations that come from the hospital authorities, the licensing boards, and most importantly, from patients. And patients in this day and age of Dr. Google have extremely high expectations of doctors. And then, you know, if you're a doctor in private practice, it's really quite hard because you're dealing with a lot of competitiveness. I mean, look at this country. We have 31 medical schools for a population of, you know, who knows how many million. We're producing doctors like there's no tomorrow, and this is going to be a serious problem, you know, soon, because there's going to be so many doctors around, and they're not in all the right places, unfortunately. And this competitive nature is stressful for some doctors, like, for example, in particular, you know, family doctors, general practitioners, you know, they're finding it hard to survive out there. So competitiveness. And, you know, for example, doctors in government service, for example, will face things like, as you mentioned, bullying. And then there's fear of whether they would ever go up on the career path, whether they'd be held back by, you know, people with, you know, grudges or what have you. And, you know, there are other things like in government service, you know, for example, there might be lack of resources to do you know, things that you need to do, and that can be quite demoralizing.
Okay. I'm just thinking all of that really applies to the general population as well.
Yes.
Except for, you know, the fact that you are in touch with patients, which can be quite a challenging, emotionally driven, profession.
Yeah, because we're in the profession of saving lives and making people's lives better. And sometimes when that doesn't always go according to plan, it can be quite devastating, quite difficult.
How do you cope with that? I mean, how do doctors generally cope with a death of a patient?
Well, I think, I don't think death is such a problem, but it's more a case of untimely death or a death that is not expected. You know, if someone is terminally ill, they're terminally ill and we know that they're going to die. So death is around us all the time. But it's circumstances surrounding the death, like, for example, suicide. Or if a young person comes in and dies of a heart attack, or or for example, if you've seen a patient for a long time and you've followed them over years and suddenly they die unexpectedly, that can be quite difficult because you developed a relationship with that person.
You know, I'm very curious. I mean, you're a psychiatrist. You deal with this on a daily basis. How do you look after your mental health?
With humor.
Really? He's not done stand-up comedy for us yet. I mean, is there potential here that we didn't know about? We'll give you your own show, Dr. Robin, if that's what you'd like.
No, that's fine. No, I think, you know, we talk to each other. You know, in the hospital that I work at, there's a doctor's mess. And we sit there and we, you know, we have coffee and we chat to each other about what's going on and moan about this and moan about that and moan about the world, if you like, you know.
I think we all do that.
Yes, absolutely. And that's, you know, a kind of therapy in itself. Yeah.
Okay. So coming back to suicide, how do you counsel family members or caregivers if they do lose someone to suicide? Well, we've spoken about support all this time, but what about if they do indeed lose that person, then how do you cope with that?
I think it's tough. One of the most important things that you need to do is to let them acknowledge that they've had a loss and it's okay to feel sad and it's okay to go through all the stages of grief, you know, that they could experience. But one of the biggest things is guilt. You know, a lot of family members would feel guilty and wonder if they could have done anything more to prevent something or if they had been able to look at the signs and all the warning signs that may or may not have been there. A lot of people feel quite guilty about such things. So we got to just, you know, walk them through that and help them learn to live with the fact that you can't always predict what someone's going to do.
That must be very difficult to deal with.
It's very hard. Yeah.
Mm. And do you continue that counselling with family members?
Well, personally, I've never had to do that because usually I would probably see family members, if they want to, once or twice. And then in my practice, certainly most people have moved on and sort of accepted things and just, you know, gone along with it. Or maybe they've gone out to seek help from other sources. I'm not sure.
Okay. And there's also something called grief therapy.
Yes.
That you're going to actually, you know, seek help for. We have a question here. I used to host a student club a while back. The club itself is built upon a small but very tightly knit group. It was only towards the end of my years as an ex-co did I realize that about a third of all my club members confessed that they were either currently seeing the school's counsellor, some of whom have attempted suicide. I just wanted to ask the doctor, what are some of the things that a student group couldn't do in such a situation? And the club members are a mix of minors and students aged 18 and above. Mm-hmm. Your thoughts, Doctor?
Sorry, what was the question again? What can...
So as a student group, how can they actually help these individuals when they're in these situations of, you know, having mental health issues and, you know, wanting to attempt suicide as well?
Well, I think firstly you need to know if someone has got a mental health issue and if they're planning to commit suicide. I've been in a situation where I've seen students talk to their peers and actually come in with their peers, and they've been very supportive and you know, stuck by them. So, what can students do? Be supportive. Allow them to try and get some help and try and steer them in that direction. But the other thing I think that's important is to have just be aware, firstly, that someone might be going through some sort of difficulties. Sometimes it's hard to tell because people don't necessarily talk about it. But then, you know, if you have a friend in a group who's kind of been missing from school for a while, who appears tired all the time or not communicative, perhaps you need to sort of probe a little bit more and find out if there's anything wrong. So, you know, an increased sense of suspicion, perhaps, you know, that something might be going on.
Okay. Your message on helping families cope with suicide?
My message, it's not easy, but it's not your fault.
Thank you for joining us today. Dr. Robin Gonzaga, consultant psychiatrist, speaking to us about helping families cope with suicide. If you do have thoughts or you need help, you can call the Befrienders on 0379568145. That number again, 7956-8145. Or you can call the Malaysian Medical, what's that association? MMHA.
Malaysian Mental Health Association.
Association, yeah. MMHA at org.my. So get help. Make that phone call and get, somebody to back you up. Thank you for joining me today, Dr. Robin. This has been Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.